But there's a song of praise that only
All right. Good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. If we can find our way back to our seat,
there is no
that would be great.
Only you, Jesus. Who else?
Much love, Walker Harbor. How's everybody feeling this morning? Good, chatty. Yep, we're nice and talkative. That's a great thing. Always a good thing. A couple things before we sink in. One, if I haven't met you, my name is Wally. I have the honor and privilege of being teaching pastor here for Walker Harbor, so I'm thrilled that you found us in this space. And it's good space, nice and humming with energy, which is beautiful and lovely. A couple things before we sink into our teaching time. Want to do a couple things, highlight a couple things. One, with the Olson adoption thing, we also have a board. I'm sorry if I missed that, Abe, if we mentioned it. Okay, got it. That's what I thought. So there is a board downstairs as you came in that has envelopes on it, and the idea there is the number on the envelopes, it could be from $1 to $99, is you grab the envelope, put money into that envelope, and then put it in the giving boxes or hand it to either myself, Sarah, Jess. That works well. And then that's all a part of this fundraiser. We kind of have two, but they're tagged along. So that's one that's been rolling. We've been doing for a few weeks. And so if you want to jump in that way, it's just a very simple way of doing so. And that'd be great. If you write a check, if you want to do a check, you write the check to the Olson family, O-L-S-E-N. So write the check to the Olson family. And again, there is a, flyers, we don't physically have them yet, right? Those are going to be at the 18th, the flyer that has a QR code. Anyways, got it. Good. So that, just so you know, so we're trying to keep it all together. I have very, very limited space in my brain, so that's not good. Now, with that, also, we love to celebrate things that are happening in our community. Probably don't want to have the hot tea on the speaker, right? Good. Got it? Beautiful. So today, I think it is in fact today, there is a couple among us that has been married as of today 40 years. And so it's just always good to say, well done, we're with you, we celebrate you, Stan and Luann Keist. So well done. So cheers, we toast you, well done. Luann has requested to come up and give a speech this morning. So, yeah, I just hate to see what happens to me later on if that were to happen. So there's that. And then also what we want to do this morning, though, is I'd like to ask Rex and Kathy Curtis. They're going to come, and we can stand right in this little gap. And then we just want to say a prayer for them, prayer over them. Rex's brother passed away, and they will be traveling to Cincinnati Tuesday morning for the memorial. So that has been a lot for their family, kind of walking with that. And if you know Rex, I know I'd said this before, but Rex is very much a glue guy, not just in community, but certainly for his family. So Rex and Kathy hold a lot of that, but just kind of wanted to pray over them as they kind of prepare. That will be a lot to take on this week and travel, getting together with family and kind of being in that. So if you want to, from where you are, put out a hand, however you want to do that, but we just want to pray over them. Gracious God, I bless you for Rex and Kathy. We love them, grateful for their lives, their family, the way that they love you, God, and lead into you. And God, in the midst of mourning, the loss of Rex's brother. Also, God, as they look to rally their family to celebrate his life as well, to reflect, to hold memories deep in their hearts, and then just to hold on to one another in the midst of grief and loss and all that that entails. God, we pray that you, as you do, that you pour your strength into them, your perseverance into them, certainly your love and your grace and your mercy into them as they kind of walk this upcoming week and all that it entails. God, that you, as you do, go before them in their travel and give them safety. And God, that you would just stir up the favorite, the best memories in their hearts of the times they shared together, the love they have, and God, that they would just be an encouragement to their family in the midst of this. We love you, God. We trust you for this, and may they feel also the presence of this community with them as they go. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. All right, as we sink into a teaching time, we've been doing a series called Created for Connection. The reality is each and every human being is created for connection. That is connection with their creator, God, and connection with one another in community. So it's part why we do this is lean into one another, that we look to take care of one another. And it's needed now more than ever because many health organizations are now very much claiming that there is just an epidemic of loneliness. We are fractured. We are divided in our society in so many ways. And what is needed now more than ever is connection. Community, to lean on one another, certainly to lean into God and what we have with our Creator, but also to create space for people who are hungry and looking for that connection. And what does that mean? So we've spent some weeks talking about that. Each week of this series, if you will, we have these little cards. They're also at Connecting Point. There's one for each week. And there's one for this morning. This morning, Searching for Meaning is the card that will be out. And they're just little cards as prompts of ways in which you can, throughout your week, throughout your life, ways in which you can step into what this looks like. Little practices. And so we'll highlight those again at the end. But they're just little things that we'll lean into as we talk about this. And specifically as we talk about searching for meaning. And I had kind of titled this, The Search Continues, if you will, as we look to this connection. What has been really exciting for me is I was looking forward to this week and next week in terms of the content that will be in within the teaching, because these next couple weeks I think are really exciting, but they're also really challenging for us as followers of Jesus, what that looks like. Because specifically the Barna Group, is a group that gauges, that does all kinds of surveys and studies, and they do a lot of the gauging of the spiritual health of our country in ways that they are constantly doing research. They had been doing research for the last 25 years and then have come to all sorts of conclusions just in this last 6 months. And they released some of the data in April, and then they released other on September 2nd. So we're going to lean into that a little bit of what has been happening in church life, but really in the spiritual cravings of people in our country specifically over the last 25 years. The first round of data that was released was in April. It reveals something rather unique and I think really interesting as it pertains to millennials. And just so we know, the dates... millennials are those born 1981 to 1996, so that go 1900. Some of us, that's hard to get our heads around, but 1981 to 1996. Gen Z is 1997 to 2012. Then you have Gen X and boomers and elders, just to get, if you were unaware of kind of how they break down these generations, they look into that. Now, specifically looking at the millennials and Gen Z, the data that they've received here recently that they've been studying for 25 years, something really fascinating has taken place as it pertains to the leading groups of people who are making ready, specifically making a commitment to following Jesus, is being led by Gen Z and millennials. More Gen Z and millennials are making commitments to Christ in the last 25 years than the other demographics. So the CEO of the Barna Group, David Kinnaman, said this about that study. Undeniably, there is renewed interest in Jesus. Many people have predicted the growing irrelevance of Christianity. However, this data shows that spiritual trends have a dynamism and can indeed change, because they have been. This is the clearest trend we've seen in more than a decade, pointing to spiritual renewal. And it's the first time Barna has recorded such spiritual interest being led by the younger generations. That is really encouraging to me. I find that really encouraging. It's really interesting. So there is a new or renewed interest in Jesus, led by young people. Now, the next round of data, though, really got my head spinning quite a bit, and I dug in a bit more to kind of get behind, this next round of data is really also quite fascinating as it pertains to church attendance. Now, we have the data stuff, the who's what. Here's who's leading church attendance, and this is in the last 25 years. Again, Gen Z and millennials attend church more regularly than any of the other generations. Isn't that interesting? So 1.9 and 1.8 Sundays a month, the younger people are participating. Gen X, boomers, and elders, what we'll look into is how that has slipped. If we go back to the year 2000, the elders were attending church 2.3 Sundays a month. So they've dropped an entire Sunday in the last 25 years. Boomers have about the same, slipped that down about a whole Sunday, while Gen X has kind of they've held steady, and the younger generations have gone up an entire Sunday. Isn't that interesting? So this is where I find it fascinating, because they're stepping in, they're making commitments to follow Jesus. Within that, they're thinking, whether they're being encouraged, however it is that they're wondering, what do I do with this new hunger for Jesus or following Jesus? Well, my understanding is we need to step into a church community. So they're doing that at a higher level. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, because something simultaneously is happening within this making a commitment to Jesus, stepping into the church, and another thing is happening, which I find interesting. One, David Kinnaman says this again about this whole attendance thing. The significant drop-off among older generations shows that the fabric of congregational life is changing. The influx of new generations represents, this is a big deal, a massive opportunity for congregational leaders, church leaders. But this renewed interest must be stewarded well. Our research clearly shows that church going alone does not in and of itself create devoted disciples. You've probably heard me say that. It's not the end-all be-all. It's important, but it's not the end-all be-all. Even with the increasing participation of younger generations, there is still the challenge of shaping hearts and minds to live out their faith beyond church participation. That is programmatic stuff. Beyond Sunday morning. How is this integrated into the fabric of everyday life? This is the challenge of the church before us. This is why we as a community do and should support folks like Andrew Keist, who's working with Youth for Christ. So most of his interactions with young people, that is high school and middle schoolers specifically, is off church Sunday type of stuff. It's actually in the public schools that there's a lot of connection happening. And all of the discipleship that takes place is happening beyond Sunday, if you will. And so supporting someone like Andrew, that means the world to me, and I know it does to us, I would hope, when we're doing things like that. I think that's really important. And there are others that are doing it outside of, say, the institution that is the church. How are we helping young people take that next right step with Jesus. Are you with me? It's kind of a big deal. Because the younger generations are hungry for Jesus. They're stepping into church, but here's where this thing gets really weird. They're also simultaneously, the younger generations are critiquing the church. You could use the word deconstructing the church, and that, I would say, is not a bad thing. They're coming in saying, we want to grow in following Jesus, and what they're doing at the same time then is they're pushing back on many of the dogmas and oppressive doctrines of the institutional church, saying we want to grow in Jesus, but when they run into the church, keeping that from happening, if you will, or being a bit of a barrier, then that is, they're also going, well, if you're not going to help us grow, then why would we want to be a part of this? Because that's our hunger. Now, here's where I was digging in and going, how is this kind of finding its way into reality? What does that look like? For the first time since before the 20th century, now none of you are alive then. So for the first time, women are not leading the growth in church attendance. Young men specifically are. Men, but young men, millennials and Gen Z males. Why? So you go, why? How is this? The central reason is because although committing to follow Jesus, young women are finding a large portion of the institutional church does not make room for them to exercise their gifts in leadership, in being pastors, and in teaching the Bible. When they come into the institution and they say, no, you can't do that, then you know what they're doing? Then I'll follow Jesus somewhere else in which I'm empowered to do so with the gifts and talents that God has put in me. What? And so I just go, uh-oh, that's a problem. So these young people are committing to following Jesus, but then there's a collision with many of these churches that are led also, here's the other barrier, they're led in ways that diminish ethnic and cultural diversity while promoting a dysfunctional loyalty to nationalism and partisan politics. In short, many of the institutions are sexist, racist, and focused on political, social, and cultural power over and against, like, following Jesus. Like, people are seeing, the young people specifically go, oh, we're supposed to follow Jesus, but then what you're promoting, what you're pitching in terms of some of this stuff, I don't get it. I thought we were following Jesus, not following a donkey or an elephant. Because that seems to be leading the way, actually. We're actually living our faith through partisan politics? I'm lost. And so young people are going, ah, no thanks, I guess I'll go elsewhere to grow in my faith. Are you with me? So there is questions coming at the church of how we will lead. So we have a growing amount of the younger generation choosing a commitment to Jesus with the desire to grow and mature in their faith, and then they're stepping into church. They're actually first going to the church and say, we'd like to be a part of it. And I just cheer that on. I think it's amazing. It's great. And I'm glad. But if the church is found as oppressive or not following the ways and teachings of Jesus, we say that out loud and it should sound shocking. And yet I bet many of us go, yeah. That doesn't always happen. How weird. The church of Jesus not following the teachings and life of Jesus. So this growth, and I do love this, is being described as a quiet revival. Because young people are saying, I'm going to follow Jesus. They go to the institution, and if the institution says, well, you got to jump through all these hoops, and it looks like this, and then they go, oh, we're going over here. They're not going to make a fuss about it. They're just going to be like, no, thank you then. No, thank you. And so it's this quiet revival that is happening still. It seems that God is moving, the Spirit is dancing, but it's happening in the margins. Okay? So I think to get at this, to lean in, to me, it comes back to what I want to lean into is we're going to get at this really fascinating amalgamation of what this collision is. We're going to begin with where Jesus begins early on in his ministry, his public ministry. His largest recorded sermon is often referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. Unless you're in the Gospel of Luke, then it's the Sermon on the Plain, flat ground. But either way, in this sermon, Jesus is kind of laying out, come follow me, this is what it looks like to walk with me in the kingdom of the heavens. So he's at the very beginning of his ministry, he's just called his students, his first students, and he's begun to teach them. And these students, Talmudim is the Hebrew word for students or disciples. As he calls them and begins to set up with them, this group is a diverse group of lower class citizens in the Galilee region. That's where he gets his followers from. This Galilee region, they're lower class, they're a mix of fishermen, a tax collector, zealots. Here's the thing, zero scholars and not one class valedictorian. These are not the best of the best in terms of schooling. They don't have all the degrees. They're actually as average as can be, and maybe even a tick below average, if you will. That's who Jesus first calls and says, come follow me, which when a rabbi does that, wow. Because they're like, he thinks I can be like him. I'm in. Because no one has ever said that about me. Are you with me? Now, in this region, so we'll throw up a map, so you get this Galilee region here that we were looking at, and this is where 90%+ of Jesus' public ministry takes place around the Galilee, the Sea of Galilee. So Cana is where he'll do his first miracle, changing water into wine. Then you have Capernaum or Kfar Nahum, Chorazin, Bethsaida, and then what you're going to do is on this side of things over here, this is the Decapolis, it goes all the way down. It is a Greek or pagan region. Very few, but there would be some Jewish people, but Jewish people who have assimilated to Greek culture would live in that area. That's going to come into play. You have Samaria. Uh-oh, the Samaritans, there's a collision there. Can't go there. They would often avoid that region. And then there is up in here this Syria, where you have Syria, and it'll come into play shortly. That area also is more Greek or Roman. It would be Roman-led, so it is very pagan as well. But this is where Jesus does most of his public ministry, calls these students, is working here. And within understanding the rabbi-Talmud-disciple relationship, these first followers of Jesus, another important thing to know about them, they would be what we would call Gen Z. They're teenagers who he calls. They're young people. Peter, as the elder disciple, could be in his young to mid-20s as the lead kind of elder disciple. The only one married amongst the boys that he calls. We're talking about high schoolers that Jesus says, you're these first followers to lead the way. Are you with me? So he's calling the young people. That's who we're doing this with. So then as the Gospel of Matthew has this thing unfold, it sounds like this. In chapter 4, verse 23 to 25, Jesus went through the Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over, remember, Syria, up into the Roman area, and people brought to him all who were ill with various diseases. Those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, those having seizures, and the paralyzed, and he healed them. Hold on, because if you're a good religious person in the first century, those things that were just listed are people you stay away from. And in fact, in society, they wouldn't be allowed to be in kind of the hub of society. They have to stay on the outskirts. You're not allowed because your ickiness is contagious. Was kind of the understanding. So Jesus said, no, bring them all to me. Whoa. And he healed them, which means he placed his hand on them. Which that alone is going to send the Pharisees, Sadducees, the religious elite into a tailspin. What is this guy doing? You're working with them, talking to them, touching them, healing them. Whoa, whoa, whoa. So then it says large crowds from ready, the Galilee, the Decapolis, more Greek people. Now they're going to come wandering this way. Jerusalem, Judea, so it's tipping all the way down and getting headquarters for the Jewish people. And the region across the Jordan, that would be the eastern side of the Jordan River is what that's talking about. They are following him, this whole group of people. It would send that whole kind of what we know as Israel, they would all be, what's going on? Rome would be going, what's happening? What's the grumbling? What's this movement? The Jewish people would go, what's happening here? Because it's not happening the way we think it should, or we religiously believe that it should. Now, next slide is another map to give us an idea. So now this area, he's doing, here's the Sea of Galilee. So all the way down to Jerusalem, people are coming up or going up from here. And then east side, here's the Jordan River. So you're getting into this area in which they're following him. You have this massive group of people coming from all over. It's from the margins, the outskirts. It's very fascinating. When this happens, the crowds start showing up. Chapter 5 kicks off this way then. When Jesus saw the crowds, big crowds coming, he went up the mountain. It's actually a foothill. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him. He began to speak and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of the heavens. You know what word is really a big deal there? Is. For you English majors, is a what? It's now. Right? It's not then. It's not. So in other words, for theirs is the kingdom of the heavens. What he's not saying is, hey, for those who are poor in spirit, when you die some other place after death, then the kingdom of heaven is yours. The kingdom of heaven of kingdom of the heavens yours now. He puts it in the present tense. That's a big deal because when we are thinking heaven, when it's the heavens, is only somewhere else after we die, you're missing what Jesus is calling people to. Live, follow me, live into the kingdom of the heavens right here, right now. Now, will it be continued, fulfilled, complete later? Yes. But it starts now. That is such a big deal. Then it says, blessed are those who mourn, and there is a movement here, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Now we're moving to, if you have this, moving in this, it's coming to you. Now the movement of this teaching is crucial. Jesus is announcing that God meets people right where they are in their bankruptness, in their emptiness, when they have nothing of spiritual value, any kind of value, when they are depleted, empty. God meets you there and loves you into newness. Do you get that? That's a big deal because it's at the heart, how these blessings or beatitudes kick off is God meeting you right where you are in your nothingness. Then what happens? Here's the thing. If you are loved when you have nothing, think of it this way. It's like a balm on a wound. You put a balm on a wound and you might go, yay, but the first reaction is what usually? If you have an open wound and you put some ointment on it, the first reaction is, ow! So the next movement is, oh, I'm so grateful for ointment on the healing, and ow, there is a crying out, right? There's a crying out. Ouch, this hurts, but ouch, I know it's good, so let's take that next step, and that's the thing. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Ready? Then you have this movement, which really is important then, because then it's meek. Now, understanding meek is it's a quiet strength. What did we mention? What's bubbling up with the younger generations? A quiet revival. You have this meekness, which is a humility, but it is really strong, and it's growing. And it says they will inherit the earth. Then you have the movement in when you have this building up, you then hunger and thirst for more. Hunger and thirst for the righteousness and the justice of God. You have a hunger for that which matters most. You're focused on the justice and righteousness, on following Jesus in that. So there is a movement, and this is the turning point. Because all of these are God meeting us right where we are in our place. Nothingness, all of that. And then there's a build. And this one, this fourth one, is a turning point. Because when you've been met there and you're blessed in your hunger and your thirst. Not when you eat, but just in hungering, that ache. You are blessed in that. Then it turns. When you're met and loved there, then what happens is a life that receives that kind of love and healing and goodness now does what? It begins to turn out and move towards the justice and righteousness. So then that would be verse 7 of Matthew. It goes like this. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. You see the movement. I'm hungering for the justice and righteousness of God. And now what I'm going to do is look outwards and say, where can I give that to others? Because I've been met in my nothingness. I now want to meet others in their lack, in their hurt, in their pain, in their suffering. In all of that, all of a sudden there is a movement out to, where are you in need? I'll meet you there, because that's what has happened to me. Are you with me? So a heart met and healed by grace begins to turn outward, hungry to help others who are hurting. A heart that gives and ready, a heart that starts giving outwards is a heart that is becoming, verse 8, what's the next one? Pure in heart. You start giving because you've received and you start giving out. That's a heart that's been cleansed. Not pure in heart because of something you've done. It's been this process that God has been doing. And it says they will see God. Now, where does this take place again? Some other place after you die? Right here, right now, right? Where do you see God? All around you. Now, all of a sudden, you have eyes. The eyes of your heart see God all around you. It is with wide open eyes of the heart, looking outward for those who need the grace that they have received. A healed heart sees past the cracks and mess in others. Because you were met in your mess, so you don't first look and go, ugh. You go, ah. Someone in need of grace. Someone who needs to be met by the love of God. So you actually have eyes of your heart sees past the cracks and the mess. Are you with me? So when we do that, there is a clarity that love brings to the heart. And that our world needs so badly. We do not judge the chaos, then we actually walk toward it to be good news to it. That's what we saw in Jesus. All of a sudden he's going and they're bringing the ick to him. And his response is, yeah, great, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And the world around him goes, whoa, 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 this is uncomfortable. And he goes, yep, I know. But how can people get better if we're going to have them living on the margins and say, you don't belong? We're dividing. We're separating. So then the next thing is now you're going out. You're actually meeting people. And then you have verse 9. Blessed are the what? Peacemakers. Ready? Not peacekeepers. Peacemakers. To live this way, you actually are creators. You're creators of peace. They love, they heal because they've been met in that. And so now we're looking to create peace wherever we are. All of our relationships, our interactions, we're creating peace. A guy named Paul, one of the first Christians, he writes to these really messy communities in the known world at that time and talks about what kind of life is a peacemaker life. He writes to the church, which would be actually all of these little house churches in a city called Corinth. Now, so you know, Corinth would be way, way messier. Ready? First century Corinth, way messier than America today. We think of things like, oh, Las Vegas is Sin City. Corinth is Sin, 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 Sin City. Really messy communities, and there are scattered amongst it little house churches of Jesus followers. Paul writes to them and says, let's talk about how you're going to live in the midst of the mess. And he says this in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. He says, love is patient. Love is kind. Pause. You're already going, oh, I hear this where? Weddings. Fine. Fine. It is good because it's stunning. This is the way to do life, but he's actually writing it to the church community. This is how you live as a follower of Jesus in all of your relationships. So in your marriage? Absolutely. So is it good for wedding ceremonies? Great. It's beautiful, but it's way bigger. Okay, sorry, soapbox. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable. It keeps no record of wrongs. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never, what? Now, your translation might say fails because that word there, that last word in the Greek is pipto, not pepto. Pipto, which means to fall, to be removed from power by death. So what it's saying is, ready? Love never actually falls, and love cannot be removed even by death. That's the kind of love that Paul is talking about, because that's the kind of love Paul has experienced, and he is teaching the church to live in that love and to live out that love. Are you with me? So when you do that, that love, I would hope we would go, that sounds powerful, that sounds good. It is, and it needs to be. Why does it need to be that kind of big, deep, powerful love? Because verse 10 of chapter 5, the next movement in the Beatitudes is, blessed are those who are persecuted for living this way, for living out the righteousness of God, for theirs is the kingdom of the heavens, which we've already had said. Because what it does is it circles back around. If you live out this love, you will get heat from the world. And that would place you, and it says, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Whose is the kingdom of heaven? Do you remember? Poor in spirit. Well, guess what happens when you live this love out and the world pummels you? You feel empty. Because what? This time you've expended yourself on behalf of love. And so you're right back at the beginning saying, God, I need you to fill me back up because I've given what you've given me. And God says, great, because I never end. I cannot fail. This love I give you has no bottom. Do you see what happens, though? There is a rhythm here within these Beatitudes of being met and then in turn meeting others where they are and loving in this big, powerful way, a love that pours itself out on behalf of others. What fills us and sustains us is what comes from Christ. It is not our effort, but Christ's energy, which I love. Father, Franciscan Father Richard Rohr says it like this. Love is not only what we do, it's how we do what we do. When we stand in the state of love that Jesus offers, we live inside a different energy. That's what people are picking up on. That's when people see the way you love and love really well and love big, and people know that's different. That there's something more there. And people are picked up on some sort of strength that is beyond what we can produce on our own. That captures the humble, gentle, and yet no less powerful love and mercy that we extend to others because it has been planted within us and watered in us by the divine gardener. So good. So needed. And then we in turn give it out. Now, going back to our studies and research that reveal the younger generation is hungering for hope and meaning, which is found in the love that Jesus speaks of. That's where the ache is, for that kind of love, for this kind of life. That we, the church, would model it and offer this love to every single person. Ready? Young in age, young in heart, anyone who's hungry, that they would find this love in us. Because in the midst of these hunger pains, there is a but, which is a really big but. Young people or hungry people are rejecting religious performance. while calling for the satisfaction of presence. What has looked to some as disengagement from the faith, that's where some go, I don't get it. Young people, they like want to follow Jesus, but they're rejecting the faith. No. They're actually rejecting a static religion. If it's not alive, I'm not interested. We'll talk more about that in a handful of weeks when we get into our next series of what these things look like. So what we would say, some say deconstruction, is actually making room for a genuine faith. This genuine faith is what Jesus speaks of. And what Jesus so brilliantly does in the Sermon on the Mount is what he's doing, it's going to be a callback to what we did for a long time, for a year, walking through the Exodus. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, in the Beatitudes, he's summarizing the history of his people, the Jewish people. Because what he is saying is, hey, remember they were met in their enslavement when they were empty, when they were bankrupt in Egypt. They had nothing. They were enslaved. God met them and God rescued them in their nothingness. And he led them through the desert for 40 years. Now, here's the thing. Now that they are out of the empire that is Egypt, they're going to spend some time in a process of getting the empire out of them. Because if you live in only this thing, when you try and go out, you're going to usually just replicate what you've been in. So God knows I need to get that out of them to teach them a new way. That's what we did for a year with the Exodus. Because here's the thing, you cannot create a society that honors God if you're simply mimicking the empire that you came out of. Are you with me? Now, and now, especially if you're like, well, we're going to do empire, but it'll be good for us. Empire. No, bad. Sadly, that's what happens in short order, though, with the Hebrew people. The Hebrew people quickly, going fast forward out of the Exodus, essentially what happens when they set up a land, when they get in a place and they set up a society, if you will, then quite quickly they'll ask for a king. Oh, we'd like a king over us. And Samuel, the prophet, says, oh, no, they're rejecting me. And God says, Samuel, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me as their king by asking for a human king. And then what happens is God says, if that's what they want, they can have it. And then eventually they spiral into chaos again. And then they get exiled to Babylon. And there God meets them in their lack, nothingness, bankrupt of spirit again, and says, let's do a whole renewal thing again of God's good ways and renew this good world. Now, the prophet Isaiah calls out to the people in this, right? In their exile, Isaiah says this. So the prophet speaks, thus, and I just love that, thus saith the Lord, right? Thus says the Lord, who makes a way in the sea. Notice where this takes place, a path in the mighty waters. It's a callback to what they experienced being rescued out of Egypt. Here's the key. Who brings out chariot and horse, army and warrior, they lay down. Whoa. They cannot rise. They are extinguished, quenched like a wick. That's not how things are going to be renewed. Whoa. Do not remember the former things or consider the things of old. I'm about to do a new thing, God says to them. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? I will make a way where? Wilderness and rivers where? So fascinating. Just so we're clear, the prophet announces, one, that military might will not be what rescues you and will not what produces freedom for you. Instead, like God did for the Hebrew people back in Egypt, he is going to once again make a way for them, but where he's going to make this happen is the wilderness and desert. Next slide. Ready? Wilderness in the Hebrew is Midbar. Midbar is the land of just enough. It's the promised land. It's desert. It's desert. You go to Israel, when we've gone to Israel, and we've done study trips in Israel, and when we get to Midbar, and we go, this is Midbar, this is the promised land, everybody on our trip goes, no, it's not. And I go, yes, it is. This is Midbar. This is the promised land. They go, no, because it looks terrible. Yeah, it's the land of just enough. You can make it there barely. But you need help from God. Then when it says desert, that's Yeshimon. Yeshimon is just a different kind of desert. It is uninhabitable. You actually can't survive in Yeshimon. It is too much, too barren. And yet, what does God say? This is where I'm going to make a way for you. It'll be in your nothingness, in your lack. You will have to rely on me in order to do this. And we'll have to do it together. That's important because, again, empire says, let's get to luxury. Let's get to where we're comfortable. Then that'll be good. And what God says is, that's not what we're doing. I'm meeting you in your nothingness, and I'm leading you this way. It's even here in the dryness and emptiness of the sin-saturated soul, God meets us, and he's doing a new thing within us and then through us, a way forward for the broken and the bankrupt. God is renewing all things. So then we go, what's a picture of this renewal beginning? The prophet Joel, yeah, says it like this. Joel says, then afterward, when this happens, God meets us, creating a way forward. Afterward, I will pour out my spirit, where? On some. All flesh, your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Boy, daughters prophesying, that sounds like they'd be teaching and leading and stuff like that. That can be. Anyways, your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions, even on the male and female slaves. Uh-oh. Wait, what? Servants, slaves, they're invited in too? Yep. In those days, I will pour out my spirit on all people. It's going, I believe a new generation of followers of Jesus are hungry for that. This is what I think they're hungry for. Whether old or young, male or female, I believe there's a youthful hunger in a growing number of people in our world. Ready? Not to build another Christendom, because that is a performative faith that chases power and merely perpetuates empire. There is an ache for a genuine trust in the work of Jesus to rescue, redeem, and renew the good world God began. The fruit will be found first in how lives are lived, then in words spoken. You will see a change in the way people live, and eventually they'll be able to put words to why they're living the way they're living. Are you with me? The hungry and genuine will not wield the Bible to get their way, but will study the word to discern the way. Let me say that again. The hungry and genuine will not wield the Bible to get their way, but will study the word to discern the way of God, Jesus. The young, gifted writer, Jordan Harrell, she, brilliant, a writer, having gone through the long, dark night of soul, helps us discern this way. It looks like this. Genocide is biblical. Find it in the Bible. Loving your enemy is biblical. Only one is Christ-like. Slavery is biblical. Chain breaking is biblical. Only one is Christ-like. Patriarchy is biblical. Countercultural elevation of women is biblical. Only one is Christ-like. Retributive violence is biblical. Grace-filled restoration is biblical. Only one is Christ-like. Segregation is biblical. Unity is biblical. Only one is Christ-like. Christ transforms, not the Bible. Be wary of those who know one but not the other. That is not, ready, taking the Bible less seriously. It's taking it more seriously. It is taking the Bible more seriously because you're going to study and dig in and not just quote text. Instead, you're going to ask what's the context and where is the arc of this narrative heading. It's heading to restoration and renewal. So then, even though we see these things in the Bible, it doesn't mean we just slap it on and say, well, it's there, so we can do it. Instead, you go, actually, as we see Jesus take these things apart and name the new thing that is happening, and so what's being put together, not taken apart then. Is Jesus saying, we're renewing this, renewing this. I think that's a strong word. This young lady wrote it really, really well. I think technically she goes, is called initially as a mommy blogger. Is a young mom. Anyways, again, it's not diminishing the Bible. It's actually taking it more seriously, poring over it, discerning, studying. That's what we need more than ever. Studying and inhaling the text in context, exhaling it, and offering the eternal oxygen to others. The eternal goodness and breath of God to others. Will we be that kind of community? Will we be that kind of community? The deeply encouraging piece in all of this is that quenching the hunger and ache is God's job, not ours. We meet people where they are, but we recognize God's the one that puts them back together, but we ought to be meeting them where they're at. We are simply to make room for the ache and the growing hunger pains of a generation that is craving life. So, last slide is this then. Will we make room, ready, for less performance, more presence? Less noise, more silence. A faith that engages the head and the heart. Memorizing scripture, beautiful, love it, good. So that it penetrates the heart and makes its way to our hands and our feet, right? It's all encompassing. It is all encompassing. Will we be the kind of community that does that? So, ready? I was just doing this. This is the way I would think. If I were to start a church tomorrow, here's what I invite. I would invite people to gather in a mix of ages and stages of life. And I would say, people that are hungry for redemptive, restorative, justice-seeking love. That's just it. We'll take that and we'll say, let's gather people together. And I would say, will you study the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Matthew? Study this for 6 months. Now, here's just the way my brain thought. I don't know how many people we got going to this, like, that we're gathering together, but let's get in groups of seven, because seven's a good biblical number. There's a wholeness. So then I thought, well, maybe we'd have seven groups. Either way, I would say, well, let's get into groups, and we'll break up in these groups, study this. For 6 months, you could have all these kind of peppering of groups, and then we'll get together after 6 months, and we'll begin to walk through the Sermon on the Mount together. And we'll teach it together, because what insights did you have, and what insights did you have when we go through this, and what insights did you have, and what insights did you have, and we'll teach through it, and we'll do it together, so we'll really sink in, and we'll watch this bubbling up of maybe a church, but it's probably actually churches that will come out of this thing that I would trust are we're going to reflect the way of Jesus to the wider community when we do that. So what if we did that? What if we did that? Like seven groups from this group. If we just said, hey, let's take seven groups from here so we keep it kind of small and we go from here. Now, here's the thing. We've got a lot going on. I was talking with Sarah about this. And I'm like, we got a lot going on right now. So instead of saying, hey, let's do this now, can we be praying about this? Thinking, dwelling, begin study, fine, now lean in. And let's say in January 2026, we start getting in groups and studying this in groups. So we'll have some time to be praying about it. Do I want to step into this? Would I be willing to host a group? We can bounce around. We don't need a bunch of scholars. We need willing, open, hungry hearts to gather in small pods and begin to study this so that we become a new kind of church for the new kind of world we're facing. That we would just keep becoming this new kind of church. So I want us to be praying about that. We'll bend towards that so we have some time when we organize some groups. Mix of old and young, male and female, churched and unchurched. Fantastic spot to invite somebody who's like, I'm really curious what's going on. And this is a bit much for people, maybe. So you go, hey, come over. We're going to actually get together in my garage and we're going to have a meal and we're going to do some reading together. We're going to have some discussion. So we'd love to have you participate in that. Are you with me? So that we would prepare ourselves for that kind of thing. Now, if you look on your card or when you get these cards, what it says on this is, One of them is commit to a new spiritual habit. How are you helping, I would say, stoke the fire? How are you helping scratch that itch? How are you going to pour into a little bit of that hunger? Seek out a spiritual mentor. This is where I think it is so important that we look to, if we are being met by God, that we are looking to meet others where they're at. And again, I think this is a whole thing of young and old and whatever that, like, yeah, great, 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 great. Maybe, again, if we don't just go with age, maybe there's like a 25-year-old that just is cooking. Is that the terminology, cooking? Oh, yeah, see, I'm not that old with God. We're just cooking, and like we got this thing going, and actually then there is like this 61-year-old who's like, I'm just getting started, this is brand new, and they go up to the 25-year-old and say, will you mentor me? Oh man, that would be something. But I think that that would be the church, and I think we could do that. And if we would look to just do these connections, how can we get together? And I know many of us are going, man, where do we find the time for that? It's all within the life that we have. How do we then create space? Yes, in our life. We're going to create space for that. To say yes to something means to say no to about 100 other things. And that is not always easy, but if we work to do that, it doesn't, and again, it's not programmatic. What you don't get from me is I'm not very good. So if you're waiting for me to, well, here's the sign-up sheet, and it's good to go. We need to do that. We need to have those things. I'm not very good. Get together. What do you mean? Get together. Get together in your garage. What do you mean? Get together in your garage. Get some food out. You don't need to run that by me. Share what you learn while you're doing it, though. That's great. That we would just do this. We would step into it. Are you with me? So that's where we're at. This is this hunger. You see this movement then. That movement is happening now. Of course it is. Will we make space? Will we create space for that to grow? To get stronger? To build up? I think, I really trust that we're ready to step into such things. Gracious God, I bless you for the opportunity we have to gather together as your body, the church. What a gift to be here. God, I love that we can both see and hear your creation humming right outside these doors. I bless you, God, for meeting us right where we are. That as we give thanks, God, that you meet us in our bankruptness, in our brokenness, in our hurt, pain, struggle, in our lack. And you are healing us, strengthening us, so that we can meet others right where they are. As we experience this renewal, this renovation of the heart, we then in turn have the eyes of our heart turned outward to those who are being pushed aside, pushed down, stepped on, judged, sent away, and God, that we would meet them where they are and love them the way you love us, knowing that it is your love through us that does that. I pray that will happen in and through this church, even here. And that we would learn more and more and more to become your hands and feet in this world that is splintered, fractured, divided, and yet deeply hungry for wholeness and health. We pray this in the name of Christ. Amen.